This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Flooding across Australia's northeast is continuing to cause chaos and shows no sign of abating. The country has now recorded its wettest spring. An area bigger than France and Germany combined has been affected.
The second wave of winter is heading into northern Britain today. Severe weather warnings have been issued for Scotland, Northern England, Northern Ireland, Wales and southwest England.
Heavy snowfall is blanketing large parts of China. A cold weather front from Siberia has made temperatures in the north plunge to a deep freeze.
We've challenged the orthodoxy surrounding global warming theories and questioned more evidence on the side of the ice age in prospect. In point of fact, research, some of it shows that we could be heading toward cooler temperatures, and it's a story you will only see here on Lou Dobbs Tonight.
I mean, it proves beyond any reasonable doubt that the actual science of global warming, irrelevant.
We all talk about the weather, and there has been more weather to talk about. Millions of people check with the Weather Underground for the latest. They want the color charts, the maps, satellite photos, and the big picture from Dr. Jeff Masters. As a meteorologist, Jeff was a hurricane hunter flying with the National Oceans and Atmospheric Administration, those planes out of Miami. He flew right into the big storms like Gilbert and finally Hurricane Hugo. In 1995, Masters co-founded a website to make real-time sense of raw data pouring out of the National Weather Service. This week, the Weather Underground was number 57 for traffic out of all the internet sites in the world. It's huge. Now, we do need some answers about the mega rains, strange hot summers, and blustery northern winters. It's a treat to have Dr. Jeff Masters join us on Radio EcoShock. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Alex.
Well, welcome to the program. You know, everyone wants to know how the Northern Hemisphere got so cold and with all that snow after one of the hottest years on record. But before we go to that, let's quickly skip to that other emergency happening on the other side of the planet. Tell us about the epic floods in Queensland, Australia.
They've had some rather remarkable rains, not just during the past couple weeks, but for the last 3 or 4 months. The spring season, which runs in the months of September, October, November, that was the rainiest period ever in 118 years of records in Australia. They got just mind-boggling amounts of rain, up to 4 feet of rain along the coast of Queensland there during those 3 months. And then December continued that rainy period. Once again, heavy rain several feet in some areas along the coast there. And finally, the straw that broke the camel's back in one part of the region was a tropical cyclone called Tasha that moved ashore on Christmas Day, dumping another foot of rain over some parts of Queensland. As a result, the rivers in the area flooded to some of the highest levels ever seen and have caused the isolation of one fairly large city along the coast, Rockhampton, with a population of 75,000, and they're having to boat in materials now, food and water, because you just can't get there via any other way.
Is there a connection between those Australian floods and the huge downpours we saw this year in Pakistan and China?
You know, it's difficult to answer that question because we simply don't have good enough records worldwide to say, well, what are the records being set for flooding amounts and comparing that to other regions where maybe you're not getting as much rain. But one thing we do know is that over the last 40 years, the amount of moisture in the atmosphere as a whole has gone up about 4% just due to global warming. A warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor. More water vapor tends to cause heavier rainfalls. In particular, the very heavy rainfall events, the ones that are, say, in the 99th percentile for heaviness, those are the ones that preferentially see an increase when you get all that extra moisture in the air. The average run-of-the-mill type precipitation events don't increase. So the type of flooding events we're seeing over the past year are consistent with what we'd expect to see in a warming world.
What about the blizzards in the U.S. and that record cold in Britain and the heavy snow throughout northern Europe? Is that just normal winter or is it something else?
Well, it's pretty abnormal winter. Northern Ireland in the British Isles, they recorded their coldest temperature on record ever in December. They hit minus 18 centigrade. They've never been that cold before. And certainly over Florida, they've had their coldest December ever, to go with one of the coldest January-February periods on record. But you stated earlier that we're talking about record cold in the Northern Hemisphere. We're talking about record cold just in some portions of the Northern Hemisphere. If you look at the Northern Hemisphere as a whole, the stats aren't in yet for December, but I'm sure it's going to be near record warmth. In fact, November was the warmest November on record globally. So you have to be careful talking about record cold because it's not hitting it everywhere. What we're seeing is a very unusual circulation in the atmosphere over the Northern Hemisphere, which is drawing a lot of cold air downward from the Arctic, but at the same time, it's allowing warm air to flow into the Arctic, making for record high temperatures there.
Right. You can't even get a skating rink to work in Quebec, Canada right now, and even further north where there are no cameras, no weather stations to speak of, and very few people. It was up to 15 degrees Celsius higher than normal, and that really didn't hit the papers here. Even Canadians didn't know about that.
Yes, that's a result of the fact that there's been a very unusual amount of Arctic sea ice loss over the waters of northeastern Canada this fall and in the early winter. And where you have that uncovered water, where usually there's ice, that means there's a lot of heat going into the atmosphere, and that heat stays there and helps warm up the land temperatures. And both last winter, which was the warmest winter on record in Canada, and now again this winter, you're seeing the effect of that sea ice loss, keeping the temperatures abnormally warm through Canada.
But I have seen different explanations for that. Some people say the jet stream has moved. We had an explanation in the New York Times that excess snow in Siberia was pushing the weather patterns around. How sure are we that the sea ice loss is impacting the climate further south?
It's difficult to separate out all these impacts because, yes, like you say, there's many natural factors as well. There's a pattern in the atmosphere called El Niño and La Niña, which is this periodic 2 to 7 year cycle in the tropical Pacific where you get alternating cold and warm waters. Those patterns affect the jet stream path, which affects the amount of cold air in Canada or wherever throughout the Northern Hemisphere. And yeah, like you said, there's snowfall in Siberia also has a big impact on global weather patterns in winter and where the position of the jet stream happens to occur. But what we do know is that large-scale changes in the temperature of the oceans, like this El Niño-La Niña pattern, do affect the weather and the climate. So it should not be a surprise to us if Arctic sea ice loss, which is uncovering huge amounts of the Arctic Ocean so that they're exposed to the air now, that should also be causing similar large-scale impacts on the weather and climate. Now, we don't have enough experience over the past few years to determine, you know, just exactly what that fingerprint is, and what we're seeing is difficult to quantify as far as, okay, what's the natural impact here and what's the impact of Arctic sea ice loss? It's just too new of a phenomena for us to be sure exactly what's going on. But I'm confident that Arctic sea ice loss does have a major factor in explaining the abnormal coldness, perhaps not of this current week, but maybe last winter and a portion of this winter.
Well, it seems pretty obvious the world climate has been destabilized to some extent, and science is really playing a catch-up trying to understand just how sensitive this system is. What if we get a few quiet years in terms of storms and floods and heat? If the climate moves in uneven steps instead of a steady progression the way most of the UN charts have been showing, we might lose focus. We might forget about climate change for a little bit. So do we know what to expect next year or even in the next 5 years?
Well, that's a good point, because if you look at 2009 as a whole, that year was relatively quiet as far as weather disasters go. Insurers paid out less than half of what they usually do for weather-related climate disasters. And I would expect that perhaps this year, 2011, might be the same way. I mean, you've got these natural ups and downs, natural variability in the weather and climate system due to chaos. And, yeah, that makes it difficult to determine that, hey, we're steadily progressing towards a more radical climate or a destabilizing climate. And I think that we do need to keep in mind that the atmosphere doesn't go in that nice steady progression like you were saying. And the risk that I see, or the worry I have, is that if we look at Earth's past climate, the relatively stable climate of the past 10,000 years is an anomaly. It doesn't normally do that. The climate normally takes big, giant swings, you know, sometimes in the period of just a few years. So we could easily snap into a completely different climate system in a relatively short period of time, just a couple of years, where suddenly the atmosphere rearranges itself into a new stable or relatively stable pattern where the jet stream moves, the typical paths of the storms take rainfall to different locations. We get drought places we're not used to seeing drought, and we get heavy rains where we're not used to seeing rains. So I think that sort of adjustment is going to occur, maybe not in the next few years, more likely at least 10 years from now, but it could occur at any time.
Well, I know that scientists have been predicting extreme rainfall events for some time. We've had guests here on Radio EcoShock saying, watch out for global wetting, if you want to call it that. It's the other half of the whole climate change picture. But most of us thought this might happen by 2100 or even 2040 at the earliest. It seems to be coming much sooner than we thought. Would that be your impression?
Yes, I think it is coming sooner than we thought. We've been looking at these climate models that are subject to considerable criticism, but you have to realize that these climate models, while they're not perfect, I mean, they have problems with their physics. The physics aren't quite good enough in them. They're not accurately representing what the climate system's doing, and they're not detailed enough. I mean, the computer power is steadily increasing, but the climate models need to get even more detailed as computer power increases so that they'll be good enough. And the climate models aren't good enough. They're not able to resolve some of these finer scale processes going on and some of these unknown things going on. And they're consistently underestimating what the impact of human-caused climate change is. None of the climate models, for instance, foresaw the collapse of Arctic sea ice the way we've seen it over the last 3 or 4 years. So, yeah, we are seeing things we didn't expect, and the watchword is expect surprises, and certainly this winter and last winter was a surprise to all climate scientists.
From my perspective, part of the problem, too, is the media lens. I mean, one reason 9/11 was so overpowering, it happened in New York at the American News Hub with live cameras mounted and ready. And this latest surprising winter weather is hitting New York and London and Berlin, Moscow, Beijing, all the biggest news centers. So we don't hear about the extra heat in South America and for a while not even in Canada. Reading that mass media, I could be forgiven for thinking the whole world is cooling, is it?
No. I mean, November was the warmest November on record, and that was despite the fact that the sun is putting out less energy than it has since we've been measuring it, and also despite the fact that we have one of these cooling events in the Pacific going on, the La Niña. Now, it's really remarkable to me that the month of November was the warmest month on record, despite those two factors which should have been dragging it down. And we'll see what the stats for December say, which are coming out just in a few days now. And it's pretty sure that the entire year, 2010, is going to wind up being the first or second warmest year on record, going back to the late 1800s.
Our guest is Dr. Jeff Masters from the Weather Underground. Jeff, it makes me wonder how long TV weather people can keep reporting these extraordinary events without ever mentioning the words climate change. It's kind of a joke around our house. We wait to see if anything like that is said. It's not. We see a long string of horrible records, and it's all just captioned weird weather. It's like it's a string of accidents with no cause. Do you have any predictions on when the mass media will really tell people what is happening here?
Well, as everyone's pretty familiar with, the climate change issue has gotten politicized. So TV weather people generally steer away from it, or a lot of times they take a skeptical point of view. In fact, I saw one poll showing that TV meteorologists tend to be maybe 50-50 on the issue. They're even more skeptical than the general public on the issue of climate change. Now, I don't really understand that very well, why that may be. But, yeah, I don't think we're going to see that change until there is an obvious imminent disaster that's due to climate change. This is what happened during the whole ozone hole crisis back in the 1980s. Well, there was a lot of scientific controversy from papers published earlier, you know, saying that, okay, well, chlorofluorocarbons and the refrigerants coming out of refrigerator systems are going to cause destruction of the ozone layer, and nobody cared really much about it or did anything until finally there was this huge hole that was found over Antarctica in the ozone layer, and everybody kind of woke up and said, whoa, you know, this is bad stuff. We better take action. So I think something equivalent to the Antarctic ozone hole is going to have to happen before anything is done, and perhaps that will be the complete collapse of Arctic sea ice in the next few years. We'll see if the site of the North Pole open to water to let Santa's workshop splash into the waves will wake people up. I think that is going to happen in the next decade, but whether it'll be enough to trigger action, we'll see. Maybe not.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Jeff Masters, one of the most influential meteorologists on the net, with the Weather Underground at wonderground.com. Jeff, in our November 19th, 2010 Radio EcoShock show, Dr. Tim Garrett from the University of Utah said climate change is really a long-term natural disaster. He suggested weather extremes produce, quote, an ever-increasing environmental pressure on civilization that continually acts as an ever-stronger force that eats away at what we have produced in the past. And when I heard that, I thought of the storm drains overwhelmed in England, the levees breaking in the United States, unhealed scars of massive flooding in Pakistan, the crops burned out in Russia. Is it possible extreme weather alone, driven by climate change, could slowly drag down the global economy?
Yeah, I think that's likely. I think that's probably at least 10 years away. But I expect 30 years from now, there's going to be a global emergency where we're just going to be overwhelmed by the large numbers of global weather disasters happening that will strain the system. Certainly the relief system is going to have trouble trying to respond to all these disasters, and crop failures are going to be a huge issue too. How are we going to feed all these people that are going to be suffering from floods and droughts? And we still have the issue of overpopulation. The population's continuing to expand, and even without climate change, we're going to bump up against the limit of there's just not enough water on the planet for everybody to have. So the future does look like it's going to be limited by the weather, the climate, the amount of water available, and we're living in the golden age kind of right now. We've got a period of difficult struggles coming up that is going to be a trial for much of the world's population to live through.
I suspect we won't be able to buy insurance anymore. It will be so expensive, only billionaires will buy it. And most people in the developing world, of course, they don't have any insurance. When they're wiped out, they've got to start from scratch. I'm wondering, do you have a couple of weather events that happened in 2010 that you feel were really underreported that you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, I'd say the number one underreported weather event was the drought in the Amazon. This is the second 100-year drought in the Amazon in the last 5 years. And just 1 year after the main tributary, the Amazon River, had its highest flood level on record, that same tributary, the Rio Negro, had its lowest level on record. So they went straight from extreme flood to extreme drought. And if that isn't a encapsulation of what we expect, you know, the future of climate change to be, I don't know what is. That is a troublesome thing, because the reason that that drought occurred was not because of the usual reason, which is El Nino, but the drought was due to extremely warm Atlantic sea surface temperatures, which is a new thing that area hasn't experienced before. Both the 2005 and 2010 droughts were thought to be due to this relatively new mechanism. And if that continues to occur in the future, I mean, we expect the sea surface temperatures to continue to rise. I mean, we could lose significant portions of the Amazon. They may simply just burn down and not be viable as a tropical rainforest anymore. And that's bad for the planet, because that ecosystem pulls out a tremendous amount of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and helps keep the planet cooler.
You used to be a storm chaser for the government. What do we know about the future of storms as we go along adding greenhouse gases?
You know, storms are kind of one of my lesser concerns. I mean, they are a concern because the strongest storms are going to get stronger, both hurricanes and winter storms. So they're going to have heavier downpours. They're going to cause bigger storm surges. But we do expect that the number of those storms is going to decrease. So one interesting thing that maybe also was underreported this year is for 2010, we saw the fewest number of tropical cyclones on record for the planet in 2010. Now, that is consistent with what climate change models have been predicting, that we will see a decrease in the number of these storms, but maybe an increase in the very strongest storms. So, yeah, storms are a concern, but I don't think it's the number one concern. My number one concern is drought followed by heavy flooding.
Our guest is super weatherman Jeff Masters, and unfortunately we are running out of time. Jeff, is there something you would like to add for our listeners?
Well, you know, I would say enjoy our 2011 weather that we have this year. There aren't going to be a whole lot more relatively stable weather years coming up if you look at the long term. I think over the next decade, most of the years will probably be relatively stable like we're used to, but we're going to see an increasing number of years like 2010, and we'll look back maybe 30 years from now at 2010 thinking, wow, you know, that was relatively quiet. So enjoy our weather while you can. It certainly is a beautiful thing that holds tremendous fascination for me, and I look forward to reporting on it for everyone over the coming decades.
I think you have a lot of work ahead of you. Jeff Masters blogs The Record Set and the news behind the news at the Weather Underground, all at wonderground.com. Jeff, quickly, how would you describe this blog for new users?
It's a weather and climate change blog that I write most days. During hurricane season, which is June through November, I tend to focus very heavily on what's going on in the Atlantic. And outside of that, I try and focus on important issues as far as weather and climate worldwide, and I will talk about the latest research findings from scientists studying climate change.
Jeff Masters, thank you so much.
Okay, Alex, pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Following that interview, here is a sample from a blog post by Jeff Masters, December 28, 2010. He begins, quote, "The remarkable post-Christmas blizzard of 2010 has ended for the United States as the storm has trekked northward into Canada. The blizzard dropped epic amounts of snow during its rampage up the U.S. northeast coast Sunday and Monday, with an incredible 32 inches falling in Rahway, New Jersey, about 15 miles southwest of New York City. The highest populated areas of New Jersey received over 2 feet of snow, including Newark Airport, which received 24.1 inches. The blizzard of 2010 dumped 20.0 inches on New York City's Central Park, making it the sixth largest snowstorm for the city in recorded history and the second top 10 snowstorm this year. Remarkably, New York City has had 4 of its top 10 snowfalls in the past decade," end quote. And in that blog entry, Jeff Masters begins to list off the top 10 snowfalls of Central Park, kind of interesting, which range from 1888 to 2 in 2010. Later, he continues under this headline, quote, "An unusual number of top 10 storms for the Northeast in recent years. The Northeast has seen an inordinate number of top 10 snowstorms in the past 10 years, raising the question of whether this is due to random chance or a change in the climate. A study by Houston and Chagnon, 2009, on the top 10 heaviest snowfalls on record for each of the 121 major U.S. cities showed no upward or downward trend in these very heaviest snowfalls during the period 1948 to 2001. It would be interesting to see if they repeated their study using data from the past decade, if the answer would change. As I stated in my blog post, The United States of Snow, in February, bigger snowstorms are not an indication that global warming is not occurring. The old adage, it's too cold to snow, has some truth to it. And there is research showing the idea that the average climate in the U.S. is colder than optimal to support the heaviest snowfalls. For example, Chagnon et al. 2006 found that for the contiguous U.S. between 1900 and 2001, 61% to 80% of all heavy snowstorms of 6 inches or more occurred during winters with above normal temperatures. The authors also found that 61 to 85% of all heavy snowstorms of 6 inches or more occurred during winters that were wetter than average. The authors conclude, quote, "A future with wetter and warmer winters, which is one outcome expected, will bring more heavy snowstorms of 6 or more inches than in 1901 to 2000, end quote. The authors found that over the U.S. as a whole, there had been a slight but significant increase in heavy snowstorms of 6 or more inches than in the 1901 to 2000 period. If the climate continues to warm, we should expect an increase in heavy snow events for a few decades until the climate grows so warm that we pass the point where winter temperatures are at the optimum for heavy snow events," end quote. That's the kind of compact facts and analysis that keeps wonderblog.com in the top most visited internet sites in the world. Plus all the snappy graphs, the satellite shots we can't show you on radio, and by the way, Wonderblog is spelled W-U-N-D-E-R blog. While most mainstream weather reporters dodge the connections to climate change or even deny it, millions of people bail out of that to get the straight news from Jeff Masters and his co-conspirators at the Weather Underground. The truth will get out. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org. News on the energy front is all over the map. Someday, I would like to be able to report the world will be burning fewer fossil fuels next year. But we cannot say that now. According to a Reuters Business Report, quote, oil demand growth jumped 2.2 million barrels per day in 2010, the biggest rise in 6 years, and forecast for an additional 1.5 million barrels per day of use in 2011, according to a Reuters poll, end quote. The world will burn even more oil, pushing up levels of greenhouse gases well past the already dangerous level. The bad news, good news coming out of that devastating flood in Queensland, Australia, is a tiny slowdown in world coal production. The Wall Street Journal reported December 30th, coal mines responsible for almost 25% of Australia's big climate-killing export have been flooded or isolated by flooding. Australia helps pollute the atmosphere by producing about a third of a billion tons of coal every year. Around 25% of that coal is temporarily halted now. The planet will catch a little bit of a break due to historic flooding, likely augmented by the same coal burning. Australia is being heavily damaged by its own polluting coal industry. The actual smokestacks are in China, producing consumer products for Western countries, Africa, South America, and the growing middle class in China itself. Now China has a new oil supply route, the first pipeline directly from Russia to northern China. According to BBC News, the pipeline between eastern Siberia and northeast China will carry 300,000 barrels a day. Russia, says the BBC, overtook Saudi Arabia as the world's largest oil producer in 2009, end quote. Little reported in Western newspapers outside business circles, China and Russia recently concluded a very significant agreement. Until now, almost all of the oil sold in the world is paid for in U.S. dollars. China and Russia have agreed to trade everything directly in their own currencies, bypassing the dollar. It is one more move away from the weakening U.S. dollar as the basis for international trade. Now the world's largest oil producer and the up-and-coming world's largest oil consumer have dumped the dollar. So it's a key question. Why did China decide to go with the car and the oil civilization rather than jumping ahead into clean energy? Why has consumerism triumphed in the East with all those brand names, even as we see resources running out and the environment severely threatened? We'll find out more in our next Radio EcoShock interview, The Chinese Consumers. The biggest, the best, the most, the worst. That is the new China, where bicycle bells turned to traffic jams in 20 years. New Manhattans rose up out of the ground. Pollution smeared the sky and the rivers. The world's biggest airport, the world's largest wind farms, the world's biggest everything, as the greatest population on Earth became consumers. As China goes, so goes the world. How Chinese consumers are transforming everything. That's the title from a new book by Carl Gerth. He's a fellow at Merton College, teaching modern Chinese history at Oxford University in Britain. Carl Gerth, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's an honor to be on your program.
Carl, I've been watching China for two decades now at least. I'm a little nervous and amazed. Economists tell us North America and Europe can be measured by the health of consumer buying. Give us a couple of snapshots of the new Chinese consumerism.
Well, when I went to China 25 years ago, I found myself transported from being a poor American college student in the U.S. to a rich person in China. The problem was there was nothing there for me to buy. Back then in the 1970s and 80s, there were just a few things that people wanted to obtain. In the 80s, things like video cassette recorders, televisions, washing machines, that sort of thing. In the 90s, their desires expanded. They wanted personal computers, mobile phones, color TVs, and more. And I think now it's gone even beyond just obtaining things to also having experiences, like studying in North America or eating at Kentucky Fried Chicken or attending an Olympics in your hometown.
And what makes this so startling is the tsunami of change from that recent era of China's leader, Chairman Mao Zedong, when it comes to acquiring and wasting stuff in the early 1960s and 70s. What were the sayings and customs that kept consumerism in check?
Well, I think the things that kept consumerism in check, you could probably point to traditional Chinese frugality and all of that, but I think a scarcity of actual things. Back then, it was more than a saying that people should be frugal. It was a fundamentally different view of the economy. Then, I think production was used as the measure of man or person and nation. And I think that was reflected in the popular culture and the newspapers at that time. Back then, when I was a student, in as late as 1986, we would read the English language newspapers, and we would usually cut out the headlines and post them on our door because they were always something along the lines of fertilizer production up 8.3%. Obviously, the culture then was privileging or praising production as the measure of China becoming a wealthy and powerful country. Now I think they've changed that completely. They've gone from seeing production as the beginning of everything to now cultivating consumption and desire as the foundation for production. China now makes too much stuff, and if you make a lot of stuff but nobody wants it, then it just sits on your shelves and it doesn't do anything for your economy. So I'm interested in the way that China has gone from the 70s of focusing on production to now focusing on consumption.
Is there a particular date when China changed tracks, and why did it happen?
There was a series of changes that began after the death of Mao Zedong in 1976 and the rise of his successor, Deng Xiaoping, which the Chinese call opening to the outside world. This is called in China also the reform era. But I think this also happens simultaneously with a new orientation towards global trade in the United States under Ronald Reagan as well as Margaret Thatcher. So China was in the right place at the right time to take advantage of these new flows of capital, technology, and know-how. They welcomed this stuff in, and it helped jumpstart these changes. By the same token, they felt like their model of the previous three decades, while making them a very egalitarian society, still made them relatively poor and weak internationally.
Would you say this was an inevitable demand from below? I mean, they're going to be seeing television and advertising from the West one way or another. Or was it a political directive from the Communist Party? Maybe you could take the case of private car ownership as an example.
Well, I think you can see it as both something that people wanted, but also something that they were pushed into wanting as well. I think the easier part of that answer is that demand from below, the idea that once the state gets out of the way and stops telling you what to do with your life, that you then exhibit a natural desire to drive around in a car. I think there's perhaps some element of that. I mean, Chinese have really taken to cars. They went from 20-some years ago from only having a couple hundred thousand cars to last year surpassing the United States as the number one car market with 13 million units. And I just read today that they're expected to sell 17 million over the course of 2010. So that, as you can see, then they're obviously taking to cars. But for me, the more interesting thing is not that people want stuff. I think we can take that as granted, but how the state plays an important role in pushing people to desire things. After all, roads don't just build themselves. And if you have cars but no roads, maybe fewer people will want cars. Likewise, neighborhoods don't just decide that they want to be demolished and moved to the outskirts of town. We've seen so much of that in China, complete neighborhoods demolished, or factories that were once at the center of the city when China was geared towards production, now being moved to the outskirts or moved to suburbs. All of these things create the new possibility, thanks to roads for cars, but also the new need for cars because people no longer live and work in the same location. I mean, I could keep going for the rest of our interview talking about the policies that the Chinese state has implemented in order to stimulate desire. Take, for instance, state banks. Once upon a time, the idea that a Chinese Communist Party state bank would lend money to people to buy something would be ludicrous. Now the Chinese banks, however, give loans for cars as well as mortgages for houses. So these are all ways in which the state plays a role in getting people to move from being frugal and holding on to their money to spending more money.
I remember in the early 1990s there was still a hope, especially from Greens in the West, that China would see our pollution, the scarcity of oil, the wars we needed, the massive deaths and injuries and car accidents. Maybe they would go directly for sustainable energy, bypassing the mistakes of the fossil fuel age. That was the dream, but it didn't happen. Why not?
Well, first, before I answer your question, I want to say that Chinese themselves saw this as late as the 90s. They saw all of the problems that you outlined. They saw the pollution. They saw the that if they went down the car route, they would lose their oil and energy independence, as they have now lost. So they saw all the problems with this, but they went ahead anyway, which makes it all the more puzzling. I think the blame and credit for China's transformation, I say credit as well, because some of this is, of course, very positive. This transformation, then, can be divided into internal and external pressures, things going on with China that made sense for them to embrace cars, as well as external pressure getting them to do the same. China, for instance, has wanted to move its citizens away from agriculture into manufacturing and then up the value chain away from manufacturing, say, stuffed toys for Disney into higher value stuff like computers or cars. So part of its strategy then of moving up the value chain is to get China to manufacture these things that require more know-how, engineers, all those sorts of things that as you transition from an agricultural to an export-oriented economy to an economy with higher value stuff. So that would be one aspect of the internal pressures for China to build these products that are desired all over the globe. The second thing, though, I like to point out, though, is the role of the WTO in all of this. In the early 1990s, China decides that in order to continue having access to export markets for all of its goods, for its stuffed Disney toys and so on, it needed to sign on to WTO so that it could have the same tariff advantages that other countries had as well. Once they sign on to that, before they become full members in 2001, they see themselves as having a very small window in which they can create internationally competitive brands in autos, in computers, in advertising agencies, and everything that you can possibly think of. So the state then sees it needs to seize the moment and create domestic car industries, indeed conglomerates and electronics and everything else that you can think of, very quickly, using its control over its domestic market to first create a foundation for those conglomerates before then later competing against the multinationals after they have much less fettered access to the Chinese markets after 2001. So again, to answer your question, I see it a very complicated picture of internal and external pressures all happening in the context of them realizing that there were significant downsides to all of this.
As you know, Carl, there's a new interest here in the West about the food, where it comes from and what we're eating and the health of it. I want to talk about some changes in Chinese food. Would you tell us about the new demand for meat and the consequences of that?
Well, growing prosperity in China has allowed Chinese to consume not just more cars, but also more meat, a source of protein that was once upon a time considered a luxury item. I certainly remember when I first started going there that we didn't eat much meat. Indeed, you could say that the purpose of the thousands of KFCs and McDonald's and other fast food restaurants popping up is explicitly to get Chinese to eat more pork, chicken, beef, and so on. And of course, it's working. 50 years after a famine killed somewhere between 20 to 30 million Chinese, they now consume something like quadruple the number of calories from animals that they did 25 years ago. As you can imagine, though, this transition from a land of famine to a land of feasts, or at least feast for a couple hundred million people, has downsides. In addition to the obvious consequences, things like childhood obesity and other health-related lifestyle illnesses, this new diet also produces billions of tons more animal manure. Much of it gets left untreated. Also, there is ever greater numbers of cattle and goats and sheep grazing on ecologically fragile hills in China, consuming all sorts of grasslands, loosening that topsoil, and contributing to those blinding windstorms that you can see by looking up China windstorm. You can see Seoul or Tokyo or places all over the world that are being affected by Chinese dust. China has become, thanks to, in part, this transition to meat-based diets, the number one exporter of dust. So we can see this literal form of blowback all the way on the west coast of North America as it gets into the jet stream. So that's part of the consequences, both for individuals, the lifestyle illnesses that come along with this, as well as ecologically.
Yes, and there's the global warming impact, which we'll get to in just a minute. This is Radio EcoShock, talking with Oxford historian and author Carl Gerth about the new Chinese consumers. Carl, your book is almost a house of mirrors. We are looking at China, but we see reflections of our own excess, like their love affair with disposable products and the avalanche of waste. Is that Chinese or is it American?
That's a tough question. I would say America's a recent invention, so I suspect there are historians out there who could point to anything that we could come up with and say there were progenitors for these things in Eurasia or Latin America or somewhere where there were other ancient civilizations. So I would say it's something that was probably invented elsewhere, seemingly perfected in America, but now extended even further in China.
What are some of the Western brand names most popular in China? What does everybody want there?
I think you'd be hard-pressed to come up with examples of companies, along with their stockholders, who don't want to be in China. Maybe we divide them up the way an economist would, between services and products. And services, you see things like restaurants, McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken. Starbucks just announced that it wants to have 1,500 stores set up. Products include things like Boeing jets to Nike shoes to Gap, GM cars, and so on. So, like I said, just about everything that you could come up with here, I imagine those companies have plans to be over there as well.
You have another subtext in the book, As China Goes, So Goes the World, which again reflects back on us, I think, the whole game of brand names, as you mentioned, products that project our personal status. And yet, China's is also famous for producing look-alike fakes. How does the world's biggest counterfeiter deal with this confusion?
Alex, I'm an historian by training, and I'm an historian of consumer culture. One of the interesting things about studying consumer culture is that those of us who study it believe that in the 20th century, people increasingly define their identity based on the consumption of branded products that there's a lot of popular media discussion about, and we communicate that meaning to other people through the consumption of these branded products. Say the way that you're driving a Prius or a Hummer or maybe in your case, Alex, riding a bicycle would say something both to you, yourself, about who you are, as well as communicate meaning to other people. Well, what happens then if you live in a world, as consumers do in China, where increasingly the brands are meaningless or not as stable as they would be in highly regulated markets, where you would trust that the brake parts of your BMW are licensed and certified by BMW to work properly? If they aren't, and that's a true case, that they're actually stuffed with hay or something, and they don't work properly, maybe then all of your ability to define yourself through the consumption of branded products and communicate with that to other people is undermined. That sounds a little bit less serious when we're talking about counterfeit toys or something like that, but it becomes much more serious when you talk about fake medicines, which are also getting into the global supply chain and emanating out of China. So you could say that China has the possibility of greatly extending consumerism to a huge number of people, but you could say that it also has the potential to undermine consumer consciousness by making us have that much less faith in the brands that we consume. I know I sometimes wonder when I go to a pharmacy and buy drugs if the items that are supposed to be in there are actually in there.
You call it consumer anxiety. Does this work? Is it real? Well, even deeper, you suggest China's political elite have purposely steered the population into consumer issues to keep them away from meaningful politics. Of course, that could never happen here. How can you back up that claim in China? What are you talking about there?
As a social cultural historian interested in urban life, I have to admit I'm much less interested in looking at elites as the movers and shakers of society as opposed to riding those people riding on trends. So I'm much less likely to point to something conspiratorial that's somewhere up at the top that they're thinking, oh, we want to stay in power. What should we do to stay in power? More bread and circus for the masses. Instead, perhaps this is even slightly more cynical, I see that voters both in North America and in China, people in China, worry more about their economic well-being and less about any other political consideration. So perhaps Chinese leaders have stumbled onto something by promoting the idea that they're the party of growth rates. I can't tell you the number of people that I've talked to who believe that the Chinese government and having an authoritarian government is responsible for its 10% growth rates over the last 30 years. I've met people in India who have said the same sort of thing. They look at China and say, if only we had a less democratic form of government. I don't think of this as some sort of cabal that's trying to stay in power by giving people bread and circus, but instead by giving people what they want, which or at least middle class is what they want, higher growth rates. So I think it's something to consider that China, on the one hand, is becoming very unequal, but at the same time, it's successfully moved hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and into these lifestyles, which everything around them, certainly popular culture, is telling them they should be grateful for.
The other thing, too, is I think we have a stereotype that there are grand leaders in a small room in total command of this vast country, whereas your book brings out case after case where local governments seem to have more power and, in fact, some things nobody can control. Would you say that's the case?
Well, you can certainly see that going back to your question about counterfeits. There's an assumption that as China begins to have more intellectual property, more brands to protect, it's going to do more to protect that. That may be true at the national level, but what happens when you have county governments that are completely dependent on the manufacturing of fakes, not only just for people locally who want to have an imitation Gucci bag, but for national and international markets? So there's all sorts of tensions exactly like the ones you're spelling out. That's why I'm the last person to point to sort of puppeteers running a government. I'm much more interested in these sort of social cultural changes that push politicians into doing things rather than seeing them as the people that are making all of the choices for the rest of us.
I agree, and I think it's true all over the world. I have a bad habit of reading American financial blogs, and there is a whole pack of pundits saying China will collapse soon due to a real estate bubble many times larger than the fallen American market and a banking bubble too. And we've seen Google Space photos of tracts of empty houses or even empty new cities in China. You say in your book the wealthiest developers are connected directly to the current rulers. Is there big trouble brewing in the Chinese real estate market, and what could that mean for the Communist Party?
Yes, I think everybody has agreed that there is a big housing bubble in China, but they've agreed on that both not just on financial blogs, but also within China at the same time. Everybody knows there's one, and the government is implementing specific policies to try to quell exactly the sort of speculation, making it harder, for instance, to buy more properties than you're actually going to occupy, or not allow you to buy them until they're actually built, all sorts of policies like that. But as with cars, and similar to here, it's already become an incredibly important part of the economy, so you don't want it to grow too quickly. On the other hand, you can't afford for it to stop. I certainly think, as your question suggests, that the burst will lead to all sorts of social tensions that are already present in Chinese society. And yes, part of that will mean that the hated rich, the people who got wealthy because of their family connections, might be even more hated. More hated to lead to a rebellion or something more serious? That's anyone's guess.
You have a whole chapter on extreme markets. Part of that is the sex trade. Can you briefly explain, and I know these are huge questions I'm asking you in a tiny time, but how population policy may be a factor in the sex trade in China?
I suppose I could boil it down to a simple formula. Traditional preference for males plus one-child policy equals society with tens of millions of more bachelors than there are women for them to marry. I can see that in China, that what starts out as something done very locally without state approval grows grows into something done by larger and larger, better capitalized, better organized groups of people until finally the state takes it over. You can see that in cases of prostitution rings in China, going from something heavily suppressed to something gradually overlooked that perhaps the police are complicit in, to eventually the police themselves or the state themselves licensing this, not only as a way of making money in down times, but also a way of giving men an outlet.
The other extreme market so hated by Western greens is the Chinese reversion to traditional medicine that demands exotic animal parts like bear claws, the tiger penis. Well, shark fins for soups isn't a medicine necessarily, but it's a terrible habit. Is China so large, do you think, that these could bring about species extinction?
I think it already is. Yeah, it's a question of scale and speed, isn't it? As with much of the impacts of Chinese consumerism, as more people can afford these once rare things, they start to buy these things, and the impact of that many more tens of millions of Chinese eating tiger penis and shark fin soup and so on means that it's creating havoc all over the world. You could add on top of that the ease which global trade makes it for Chinese consumers to obtain shark fins from as far away as the Chilean coast. And there are, of course, efforts in China to reverse some of this. There are PR campaigns with famous Chinese actors and public figures trying to tell people that they shouldn't end their wedding with the traditional shark fin soup, that rather than being a sign of class, it's a sign of ignorance. But I think that those sort of things have a long way to go, and whether they occur quickly enough and change people's minds quickly enough to save all of those species is anyone's guess. It doesn't look very promising, though.
But you do raise an important point that we're not trying to demonize this wonderful country. That there are so many positive things going on, and everything that you and I are debating are definitely talked about in China, and there are efforts on almost everything to try and correct the course where there are problems. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Carl Gerth with a new book, As China Goes, So Goes the World. As we've seen, hundreds of millions of Chinese people have bought into the Western ideal of consumerism. They love televisions, mobile phones, refrigerators, air conditioners, and all the electronic goodies. Almost 70% of that runs on coal-fired electricity, burned inefficiently with low-grade equipment. Carl, the right-wing voice of U.S. business, the Heritage Institute, who I love to quote, claims Chinese dependence on coal is, quote, an insuperable obstacle to an international climate agreement. Their graph shows Chinese coal burning quadrupled from around 200 million tons in 1999 to 826 million tons in 2009, and now the government has stopped publishing those coal statistics. How serious is this problem of coal burning in China?
Alex, I'm a regular listener to your program, so I could point to any number of insuperable obstacles to international climate agreements. The question for the Heritage Foundation is, why are you picking this one? And you might add on top of that, what sort of complicity does the U.S. have in Chinese burning coal, and what sort of complicity will we have in the coming decades? I don't think I need to remind your listeners that the U.S. is the Saudi Arabia of coal. Well, what happens as we increasingly become even more indebted to China, as Chinese need more and more coal? It's pretty easy to imagine that Wyoming and Western state congressional delegations push to sell more and more coal and keep coal out of climate negotiations. So I think the problem is, as you said, the problem is that Chinese are burning way too much coal, but I think it's not just their problem, as you said at the end of your earlier question. It's a problem for all of us.
And they're producing things in those factories to sell back to us, so some of that is our coal burning.
Exactly.
A couple of weeks ago in December, news agencies reported some Chinese cities were running low on coal or even rolling blackouts. And I know nothing is simple in China. These articles mentioned that coal producers say the government fixed prices too low, and some local governments are actually trying to achieve energy efficiency targets set by the central government in Beijing. And of course, it's a colder winter than expected. But they could be perilously close to peak coal, and I know they're trying to get it from Australia and from Canada and anywhere they can find it.
Yeah, I can't speak to whether or not they're close to peak oil or not, but we can all certainly see that they're looking around very anxiously to find new resources, and that quest to find new resources is only going to continue. Fortunately, as you suggested earlier, it occasionally has some upsides, like them embracing green technologies and rushing towards that as well.
I was surprised to learn from your book that one quarter of China is already a desert, and that that area is growing rapidly, partly due to consumer demands, but there are also deeper water problems involved in Chinese agriculture. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, well, I have to admit that final chapter of my book on the environment, where I pulled together all of the things going on in the Chinese environment, was pretty eye-opening for me as well. I think, like many specialists on China, I was aware of the various problems, but it never put them together in one chapter. And when you do put them together, they're very serious. I think desertification or sandification, as you've said, is a serious problem. You can look on those satellite images and see that Beijing may be uninhabitable in the coming decade or two at the most, especially if this massive south-north water project doesn't work. And yes, water is a significant issue already on the North China Plain, the breadbasket of China. Most of Chinese land on that plain is irrigated, meaning they pump the water out of the ground. Those tables are dropping very quickly. China is becoming a very arid place, and I think solving those problems, I find it hard to believe that as much faith as Chinese have in engineers, that they can engineer their way out of all of these problems simultaneously.
Well, we've certainly covered some doom and gloom. Can you give us a couple of fun shots, the way Chinese people express themselves in what they buy and these consumer trends?
I think we can look in the mirror or look in the shopping or think about the ways in which we ourselves, including me, after writing a book that includes a lot of doom and gloom, I enjoy consumerism as much as the next person. I like to have a choice in the vegetarian restaurants that I go to in China. When I first started going to China 25 years ago, in the wintertime, all we had was bai cai, Chinese cabbage, day after day of bai cai, with occasionally some other thing thrown in. But now you can eat some of the best food in China. You can go to some of the most beautiful buildings in China. You can find some of the most beautiful or well-stocked shopping malls, some of the nicest dresses, some of the best art. There are endless numbers of consumerism that we all celebrate and enjoy, and that the Chinese also celebrate and enjoy, as well they should. I've seen them make 20-plus years of sacrifices in order to have one fraction of the quality of life that we do. So I think all of these things are wonderful. As I said, I'm not trying to cast aspersions. I'm only trying to suggest that their problem is our problem.
And I guess as a historian, you know, I struggle to look into the history of China, and it's very difficult for somebody outside to even comprehend the basics of it. And the records are not what we expect in Western records of European-style history. So are you seeing those long, deep trends that went on for centuries in Chinese history, are they still bubbling to the surface in this new industrialization?
It depends what sort of trends you're talking about. Certainly, one of the things that we're all curious about is whether or not the individualism that's such a fundamental part of consumerism, that you get to create your own identity from the infinite number of possibilities out there provided by all of that consumer stuff, whether or not that the Chinese will have as much appreciation or tolerance, depending on your point of view, of that level of individualism, or whether they'll be much more comfortable at the level of the state checking that. We certainly saw that in 2008. I remember that green organizations after 2008 openly began to wonder whether or not the authoritarian traditions of China, which we spent 20 years castigating, might not be part of an answer for scaling back consumption. In 2008, I'm pointing to that because we all remember that Beijing made enormous efforts to reduce the air pollution, and one of the ways they did that was to decide that on odd or even days, you weren't allowed to drive your car. So if your car ended, your license plate ended in a 5, you weren't able to drive on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and vice versa if you ended in an even number. So I think there are traditions of governance and collective, looking out for collective good that continue down to the present that have been suppressed for a while there are signs that are starting to reemerge.
And certainly the academic training is only going to serve them well. As we wrap up, what have we missed, Carl? Is there something you would like to add?
I remember 25 years ago when I first started learning Chinese, I had a sort of odd experience. I'd look up words in Chinese, and I'd find that I didn't know their English equivalents. The reason I mention this is that I found that learning Chinese also gave me a deeper appreciation for English. I would suggest that the same is true with grappling with issues of consumerism, of environmentalism, of extreme markets, and all the other topics that we talked about, that by looking at these issues in the context of China or India or some other country than your own will give you a new perspective on these same issues.
We've been delving into the new consumer culture sweeping China. The book is As China Goes, So Goes the World, How Chinese Consumers Are Transforming Everything by Oxford historian Carl Gerth. The book is short and full of facts and ideas that kind of punch me in the face on every page. I like it. Carl, I was astonished at some of those raw numbers you brought out, just how anything could be that big, how everything could be that big. I've got links to Carl and the website for his book in the Radio EcoShock show blog for this program at ecoshock.info, or download this interview as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. Carl Gerth, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.